Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And today I have a special guest for you. The book is The Business of Architecture, Your Guide to a Financially Successful Firm by Kathy Dixon, Timothy Kephart, and Carl Moody, published by Routledge in 2018. So, hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tricia. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. Tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I am a practicing architect in the Washington, D.C. area. Grew up in Maryland, went to school in the D.C. area, Harvard University. I did the East Coast and West Coast. I went to UCLA for graduate school and did a degree in planning. But currently, I run my own firm, K. Dixon Architecture, established in 2003. And we are focusing on commercial buildings, everything, a commercial office, schools, science lab and technology buildings. So we do the gamut of all types of design services.
And so let me ask you, what was your motivation for writing this book?
Sure. When we first started talking about it, somewhere around 2014, 2015, we had conversations about the challenges of the architectural profession. We learn a lot in architecture school about designing, but not so much about how to run a firm and just the business of running a firm. So as you know, the company was trying to grow and different opportunities were out there, I really wanted to share the wisdom that I had gained with others who were in the profession, especially younger people just coming out of school or younger architects also trying to grow their own firms, just trying to pass on some wisdom about what I had learned.
So let me start with, in your preference, you said, I wrote this book because I feel there is a critical need for the architecture industry to conduct a self-examination and essentially reinvent itself. So what is it that architecture needs to do to keep prospering and growing?
Sure. I guess one of the most evident problems is that people really don't understand what the architect does. People will ask you what you do for a living, and then you say, I'm an architect, and they say, oh, you draw blueprints, which may have been true years ago, but today we do so much more, and even then we did so much more than just draw pretty pictures. The architect is very much the orchestrator of a large team of people. It takes a lot of different minds, disciplines to put a building together. So, you know, the architect is playing that crucial role of funneling or a lot of information, a lot of different sources of information into a solution. People don't really know that. They see the end result as the building, but they don't see all of the effort, brain power that goes into managing the knowledge that's required to make design the structure to be functional and to be, of course, stable and usable. So I think that's the biggest challenge of architects not having that sort of PR and the public not knowing what we do. And then on top of that is the you know, the issue of focusing just on design and not so much on running a practice or running a company, because the problem becomes it's hard to sell design services the same way that you would sell a product, like in other industries. And other industries are doing very creative things with business-wise, you know, mergers, acquisitions, and these other things that architects were not doing so much. A sole proprietor or a professional will, you know, work until architects never retire. They'll work forever. And then, you know, when they pass, the business closes. And that's not really ideal for running a business. You want a succession plan. These are just a few of the things that are the problem with architecture today.
And in your first chapter here, it's architecture today, the current state of the profession. I like that. Architecture is a well-respected profession. It's been around for thousands of years. Think about it, all the way back Rome, pre-Rome.
Sure.
All the great architecture that we all love to visit in Europe. But you know, you talk about, you know, the public's general impression is that it's for the elite. Can I ask you, is architecture for everyone or just the elite?
Absolutely, because we all experience architecture every day. Most of us have a home, we go to an office, we go to community buildings, whether it's the library, fire station, police stations, these places that we interact with, and we all should. It's been said architecture influences us and we influence the architecture. I think it's important that people have a good understanding about how important their built environment is. I believe other countries sort of put more of an interest and importance in young children learning about the built environment in architecture. We do less of that here in the United States, and I think that's unfortunate because it's people should learn early on about just how architecture influences them, and then how they can influence their own communities in architecture.
That's true. It kind of gets into a little bit of urban planning too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about people. We talk about here about the demographics and. Since we're both women here, I'm in landscape architecture, but it's, you know, we just do the outside of the building. Mm-hmm. And the dismal numbers for women in architecture school. How are you addressing that at your, in this book and at your school?
Absolutely. It's interesting. I'll touch on the urban planning just for a minute. I did the urban planning as a master's degree because I wanted to understand the context that the building goes into. So architecture is really just focusing on that single building, but urban planning, urban design is what's happening outside of the building. And as you know, as a landscape architect, it influences the building, how the whole city and community is perceived. So that's very important. Today, we're fortunate that there are many more women in the profession. Many of the architecture schools across the country are almost 50% female today, and we're making great strides in the number of women who are in the profession. I think a number somewhere between 17 and 20% licensed architects are women. We're getting there. We're certainly trying. My own firm, we have 60% women and people of color on the staff. So we're very much trying to make sure that everyone has the equal opportunity to advance.
Okay, this is getting a little bit off subject, but still kind of relevant. Mm-hmm. What are some of the barriers to women entering this profession, and how do you address that?
Sure. Often women who want to go into the architect's profession, sometimes they get deterred may pursue more of what may be viewed as more of a female or woman-oriented field as the interior design field. Sometimes that does happen. Others will get into the profession and because of the very long work hours expected and issues of planning, family planning and having families, they may opt out or at some point opt out of architecture and move to another field if they have to be out for a while raising children or what have you, then sometimes the technology moves so quickly you have to really catch up. And that is another reason that women may not stay in the profession after they get into the profession. So there are challenges, but I am pleasantly, very, very happy that a lot more women are going into entering and staying in the profession.
Well, that kind of goes to your next chapter. You wrote this one. It was transitioning from academia to corporate culture. And in here you talk about, for most schools of architecture, the faculty is comprised largely of staff who are not present in daily in the daily architectural practice environment, and thus cannot provide the level of real world experience that's needed by today's emerging professionals. How do you address that in your own business and at your own school? You know, I kind of understand that, you know, you really wanted to learn real stuff.
Right. This is certainly a challenge. I'm fortunate to be at a university where all of the professors, all the instructors have been licensed and practicing architects, but that's extremely unusual for a school of architecture. Many times they're not licensed or practicing architects at the academic level. So I think there are certain, I think we should strive to make sure that they are practicing and licensed, because I can bring in real world projects for the students to actually work on and see, and they'll, over time they'll get to experience it, come to life. Maybe they didn't design it, but they can certainly experience that project that they worked on under someone else's hands and direction and design comes to fruition, and they're watching it. It does make a difference for them. There is each school of architecture, some focus more on technology and some focus on concept and theory. We've got to get more of a balance, between the technical, the concept and theory, and the business, talking about how do you actually run a business, practice architecture, and potentially take some other classes outside of the school of architecture for that purpose.
Yeah, and here you talk about, so what is the effect on the industry if emerging professionals could start their careers equipped with knowledge to be successful business people? Imagine if they could hit the ground running. Is that possible from architecture schools? Can you say here it takes 15 to 20 years after a freshman enrolls to learn and develop these skills? How can they, if they want to do their own business, how can they skip ahead or jump ahead?
Right. It's a long road. It's a long, slow road. But we are making progress in that, even just getting licensed. It used to be people did not even get licensed till they were over 30 years old. But today the licensing requirements have changed. You can take exams immediately after graduation, or even you can start testing, I think, while in school. So, you can come out, or start your career earlier, being licensed. Now that doesn't mean that you've learned how to run the business. So I think encouraging emerging professionals to be involved in internships during their school years, during their academic years. And that's going to be a really strong learning lesson to help the students to get ahead. And then interacting with other disciplines. We do it as professionals, we do it every day. We work side by side with all types of engineers, but at the academic level, the architects are not necessarily working with the engineering students, the architecture department. So these types of nuances, I think, could help a great deal in getting students more prepared for coming out into the profession.
So here's the crux of the book here. This is it. So the big question: what makes a successful business? What do you think?
Yes, that is. It's always this. We live in a capitalist society, so it's always going to be revenue, right? Your returns on your product, your services that you're selling. But there's so many other things that architects identify with: helping the community build, making a better built environment. Today you've got sustainability and resiliency issues, of course, social equity and justice issues. There's many markers that I think need to be weigh in on whether you're being successful, in addition to the revenue, because everyone goes into business to make money. So architects have a I guess the myth is that architects just enjoy what they do and don't really care about getting paid for it. But that's not a businessman. That's a hobby. If you're in practice and you're running a business, you need to make the money. So I think just recognizing that and working toward that early on is important for anyone who wants to enter the profession.
We've got a couple things here. You talk about provide strong leadership, put together a good team, keep open communication lines. So this is always a big topic in architecture schools is, so how do you put together a good team?
Yes, having people who can think creatively and everyone says think out of the box, but it's true. It's someone who's not going to always take the traditional approach and think of things in a different way is really the type of person that you want on your team. Sometimes it takes, a little more time or hours to put into that presentation to win the project or to go above and beyond what the client's expectations are. But it's those type of people that you really want on your team to be the most successful. Of course, you want a diverse staff, as I mentioned before. That's in many ways, age, culture, types of buildings that they've worked on. You want just all the different types of thinking, ideology that you can get in a room when you're trying to provide a solution. So I think that really helps in developing the best team.
Well, that kind of goes into, this is Carl's chapter here. It talks about mm-hmm. teamwork. You've got leadership matters, organizational structure in the firm. So what's so important about organizational structure in a firm? How does that make it work or make it not work?
This is something we discuss all the time within our firm because the people have a tendency to want a very organized, hierarchical system for their structure, and most firms too. And I think I talked about that in the book. But what we've actually been practicing over the last year or two is more of a flat flat structure where no one is, the lines of hierarchy aren't there and everyone sort of gets to contribute everywhere. So it's much more loose. Some people don't like to work in that kind of environment, but I think, well, it's still an experiment. I can't say if it's working or not, but I think if we continue this road, we've been growing, and I think it's going to help us continue to grow in this manner.
What do you do in your firm? How do you put together your organizational teams and structure? What kind of titles do you use? You're talking about titles.
Right. We have principals, associate principals, and then our senior staff, be them project managers or project architects, and then mid-level staff, architects and interior designers, and of course emerging professionals. After that, people who are just coming out of school. So we have the titles, but they're not defined. Said line of a hierarchy between design studios or the way that you have to go to move forward or move up in the firm. It's much more flexible, I think, than a typical firm.
Well, that sounds good for learning because then you're right alongside other people and you're kind of learning and doing at the same time with the more experienced professionals then.
Correct. You can learn from more experienced professionals and you can learn about different projects and things because you have the opportunity to work on different projects as well as doing different things. You might be doing business development one day or, working on construction documents the next day or doing some marketing. It really depends on what the firm needs, especially a smaller size firm. So everyone has to wear a lot of hats, and then you do learn a lot more that way.
Well, here's everyone's favorite topic. In another chapter, you got profit centers. What's going to generate the income for this business? What are profit centers that you found that work best in the architecture profession?
Right. There's few ways of looking at it. Of course, there's market sectors, and when you have downturns in the economy or recessions, you want to make sure that you are diversified in your market sectors. We have been sort of focused our bread and butter on K-12 projects, school projects, but we're getting into more science, STEM, technology projects. It's more of a niche and more steady work, you could say. Of course, higher education is another market sector that we are trying to move forward in as well. That's a harder market sector to get into, but it's a more, I think, stable one. And there are others as well, but targeting your firm to certain markets, federal is the other one that I missed. We're looking to do more federal government work also, and that's a way of making sure that when a recession comes or economic downturn, one market will go down, but another market will go up, or at least you have some that stays steady. So that's an important thing to have, or that your firm looks at being very diverse in the types of markets that you pursue.
Well, then this kind of leads to one part of this book I thought was really interesting, and it was about comparing like architecture rates to, say, lawyers. And you say in here, boosting the revenue by increasing value proposition. And, you know, why do designers get hired? How do we get paid? And yet you're saying also, you know, that the legal profession, you know, they don't struggle with these issues. They do. They could charge $300, $400, $700 an hour. How can architecture do better?
Right. That's a difficult one because, again, goes back to the public understanding what the architect does. The architects don't typically charge per, you know, every 15 minutes for our work like a lawyer does, or even for medicine. People don't really understand what doctors do. They're typically not going to try and do on their own the things that a doctor or a lawyer do, but people do try to be their own architect often, or designer. So I think people would understand the intellectual knowledge that goes into designing and building well, then I think they would be more likely to pay at the higher levels for the services that the architect provides.
How do we charge more? Did you find a way to, how do you sell yourself better to justify these hourly rates and find new mm-hmm. sources of income?
Right. That sort of goes back to delivering more for the client. You have to educate the client as you're going along and provide the solution, but you've got to sort of go a step further and provide more than what they're looking for, right? Because that once they are satisfied, more than satisfied, they're really happy, then you can hopefully rely on referrals and repeat clients at that point. It's difficult. It's just, like I said, it's not like selling a product. Services are very, I guess, more suggestive, you could say. But it's going above and beyond is one way of being able to ask for and receive higher hourly rates with your services.
Well, that's true. And you kind of go into that a little bit more here with process versus product. And architects have to constantly explain that design is a process. What do you do for your clients? How do you explain to them the value of design? But there's so many things out there today. Like, you know, we've got Home and Garden Channel. We've got mm-hmm. a lot of mm-hmm. DIY software. It's kind of a devil's advocate question. So what's the difference between us and just, you know, picking up some software and I could design it myself?
Right, right. Well, there's just so many things that goes into a design project. You don't half of it you don't know until you do get into it. And then, educating the client, bringing them along, giving them several solutions and explaining the reasons for the solutions and why one solution might have gone this way and why another one went that way. And then tying it back to the client's own vision, a mission, their goals. That is the important part of leading the client along and then determining really the best solution for whatever situation it is.
And it's all individual too. It's, you know, about knowing space and everything in that. So, well, I didn't actually know this until I read this in your book. You're talking about learning from the Apple process. Can you tell us what is the Apple design process?
Well, Apple focuses on the end user and their how they're going to use the product and making it look good. It's less about the technical issues. It's sort of just the opposite of what we're trying to do. Less about the technology of it, but it's more about how you're going to benefit from using it in the end. Architects could potentially do that, and I think we do, in the sense that people experience the building and enjoy it. But I don't really think they understand the decisions that were made and why something's placed here or there, or why one thing is one color and another, or a type of material or other. There's just so many reasons that it happens, whether it's human ergonomics or how we respond to our environments, or if it's code related, or if it's cost related. Just so many things that could sway which way it goes.
Yeah, and it's talking about, you know, how do they afford their design process, but then again, they can also replicate what they do too.
Yes, that's very true. It's the same every time, and design is not like that.
Can architects resell and sell what they do, like Apple?
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is something I've had many conversations about as well. Some architects will say that's taboo and it's absolutely sacrilege to consider. Others, I think, are more open to the idea because there is a certain amount of information or design that can be passed from one project, like a prototype from one project to another. And with some site adaptation, you could potentially reuse the basis of that project elsewhere on another site. Very few people have tried it. You do see home plans. That's one sort of product commodity that's taken off since Sears houses, Sears and Roebuck houses hundreds of years ago. But today, there's still house plans online. You can buy those, but it really hasn't gone much further than houses, maybe even churches that you can sort of package and resell the plans to. But that's something I think that may be coming in the future. And if architects aren't careful, someone else outside of the industry will come in and provide that solution if it's what the user or the end user wants. So again, the architect needs to be more savvy about business in that regard, because we could be more pushed out further from the profession than we have been already.
Well, that's true. Actually, I have built my own house before mm-hmm. I went to school, actually. I had a photography business, and the gentleman beside me had a draftsman business. And he said, well, here you go, Trish. This is your small section for your budget. I went, okay. Mm-hmm. But I picked a house plan that I liked. And then, mm-hmm. of course, he's a friend. So he worked it a little bit. And it was somebody previously on his staff. We had a big firm. And I hired a general contractor and I built it. And it turned out fabulous. But yeah, it just started off as a stock plan.
Mm. Right. I guess you would know if there are things or features in the house that maybe you would have liked to have done differently, had the architect designed it from from scratch. I don't know, but certainly I think in most situations they could do exactly what you did and be pretty happy with the result.
I'd say in that situation for my budget, I was very happy with the result. Because we did some things, but if I had a bigger budget, then
sure, the sky's the limit.
Well, you know, I'd have a small bathroom, mm-hmm. and the laundry room, you know, but really, I think for the most part, yeah, you know, starting with the stock plan was good. It gave me a foundation, mm-hmm. and then tweaking it, and then I added my own little things nice to it. Like I had like a little Whirlpool bathtub, so that was my little treat. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. so yeah, you know, it was for what it was and for that budget, it was a great little house. I don't have any complaints. So yeah, I can see how, you know, even starting with that for me as from coming at it, I came out as a client first. That was really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right. But you can understand how, I guess some architects would think that that's, you know, so taboo to do something like that, because every project should be custom and special and all this. So it's going to take, I think, some of the profession some time to adapt again to that, going into more maybe commercial buildings. And we'll see.
Well, I mean, I think this book is about thinking outside the box too.
Right.
And I would say, I'll say his name. It was Mick McGrail, American House Plans. Mm-hmm. He had a great little business. And and especially for a client like me, obviously he did custom plans and big stuff. But for the little person like me, that was a great starter house. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's right. Definitely an opportunity. And that kind of goes into this, you know, the architect as a developer. So do architects go into developing their own projects, or how does that work?
Yes, that's something that I would certainly encourage any architect to look into, and something we are looking to get into ourselves, because the architect knows the process from, you know, finding the site, what sites to look for, to designing the building, to constructing the building, and since we know the process, why not take charge of the entire process rather than just being involved in the design portion? Because of the way the design and construction industry works, typically general contractors or developers, they take the lead because they have the financial means to do so. The person with the money takes charge of the project. So that's the developer. But if the architect becomes the developer, they can have more say in the project. They can, you know, determine the site, what the site needs, have to do some market analysis, see what people need at that particular site, and then design it and build it. The architect's issue again is the financial or the business aspect, which, you know, we don't have the quite experience with how to get that. Funding, how to make real estate financing work, and then actually build the project, and then make a return on that down the road. So I think it's something that we can do, and it has been done. We talk about Portman in Atlanta and some other architects that have done it in the past, and. Again, I would certainly encourage architects to look at that as a way to grow their practices and be more successful in the industry.
So what kind of projects did he do? You mentioned Portman in here. Can you name a project that he did that was successful?
Yes, he did I believe it was the Atlanta Hilton projects, or I'm sorry, Hyatt projects, and with the atrium, that was his unique feature, the large open atrium for the hotels. And he developed several of those for that company and was very successful doing it.
So you also put here, you know, reality check. So what's a reality check of really getting into a business like that? I mean, you're not going to start something like that on a credit card.
True, true. I tell my students and young people, make sure that you have good credit, even from, you know, as a freshman, because you're going to need to build on that credit, get loans and things as you get into your career. So it's very important to know how to access money. And that's not something that students are taught or, you know, early in your career, right? So again, those taking those business classes, real estate finance class or something early on would be a very helpful thing. And then, you know, partnering with those business students, looking at, instead of just, you know, finding another architect partner to open your firm with, find someone who's maybe not in architecture and try to build the business that way. Because not everyone should have different skill sets that they bring to the table.
Okay, well, I'm going to change one sentence in your book here, because you put it twice. You put cash is king. I'm going to say, you know what, cash is also queen now.
Right, right. And Bitcoin and all the other sort of technical ways of paying for things. We've got to keep up with technology. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So that's true. I had business classes, mm-hmm. my first undergraduate program, and that's really important. You talk about here too, about the basics of financial management. So what are the good basics of financial management?
Right. Having your team around you, your accountant, your attorneys, having the correct software. That's something that we struggle with as architects, because accounting software is not really written for the architecture firm. There's a few out there that, I think we mentioned in the book, Arca Office, or it's got a new name now, but Deltek for the big firms and some other product solutions, but there aren't a whole lot. And it's really sort of challenging for the architect, because we do build differently than other industries. So that is important to examine the options for your accounting software and start to utilize and track your tracking hours and your invoices and how it even can use it for your marketing efforts and these things. So I think that's extremely important for someone who's starting out, to make sure you have the right technology, as in the accounting software.
Oh, yeah, you do. You mentioned some here. You've got Deltek, BillQuick. And I hadn't heard of this one, Archie Office.
Yes, I think they've changed the name now, but I use that. It's a good product, specifically for architects. I think it was designed by an architect, so it's a good product.
Now, I think this is, you know, sometimes you have to get into the nitty-gritty, and we talk about this a little bit in your book about pricing, you know, project pricing, hourly billing. What is a future business person to do? Understanding professional fees and fee structures. I guess there's no, how do you do it? What do you do?
Right. Yes. That's, there aren't a lot of sources that help you to price your services or know what the going hourly rates are for other architects. You sort of have to wing it for a while. There's one gentleman, and I think it's SFIA.net in California, and he's for years has been tracking architectural fees and project fees and providing percentages, typical percentages across the country or different regions of the country, what architecture firms are charging. So that has been very helpful, but a lot of people don't even know that exists. And unfortunately, again, it's only the only source that I have found for that information. So things like that really, I think, are challenges for the industry to know. I mean, what is going to be accepted by the client as far as your billing rate is important.
Well, that's true. When I had a photography business, really, I mean, it had just become such an accepted norm to have charge a session fee and then charge for the prints. If you try to break out of that too far, yeah, you just come up against resistance.
Right, right.
And doing that. So you kind of just have to get creative and make sure that you stay profitable.
Yes, that's correct. I think organizations, like the AIA can provide some information, but it really is a challenge to the profession about especially for young people entering the business. I get questions all the time. How much should I charge for this project? Or, what should my hourly rates be? And it's really hard to give a number.
To do that. And that kind of goes to this, the right fit, hiring people and finding clients. And I will say, if any of my past photography clients are listening, I loved all of you. Even a couple cranky ones every now and then. Mm-hmm. I took it as an extra challenge, to make people happy. So how do you find the right clients?
Yes, that can be a struggle, because even if you believe you found the right client, and then slowly learning that client, you might realize, well, maybe I'm it wasn't what I thought. Because a lot of people don't hire architects or require architectural services on a regular basis, so they don't understand what it's like to work with an architect and what is needed. In addition, yes, you have the architect, but there's a whole team, the engineers and permit expediters and reviewers, inspectors, whatever else that might come along with it. The client might not be aware and has to be, again, educated on these things. So, and a client that's already aware and educated on the design and construction process is your ideal client. They know what they want, and you just have to, work with them to get there. But the client that is maybe not as savvy and needs a lot more handholding is a little more challenging.
Yeah, that's true. And then it kind of goes into, especially when, discussing with clients about copyright and talk about intellectual property and who owns it. And, that's tough in photography, and it, with digital came in that clients demanded copyright to the digital files. And, I'm not sure if I agree with this, but we all have heard this. I didn't know who said it, though. Charles Colton famously said, "Imitation is a sincerest form of flattery." I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that. What do you think?
Right. Yes. I've heard that same saying, and that sort of takes me back to the commodification of the design drawings. When you're using the same drawing over and over again, that could maybe be a matter of looking at that quote. But we have the same issue as you have with photography. Some clients, the public clients, they will, in their contracts, say that they have ownership or intellectual property of the design when it's done, and the architect typically will agree to that, or maybe not. They may be able to write it out of the contract. But other entities, especially private or residential or what have you, may believe that they have the copyright on those drawings when they're done, and they actually do not. So that's another thing that the public has to be educated about with regard to working with an architect.
Well, that kind of goes right into your last chapter here. So you've got all this intellectual property. You've done a business for however many decades, let's say. So how much is your firm worth, and how do you sell it?
Yes, this is, I've been involved with merger. I actually purchased another firm in it was 2016, and to learn a little bit up front and personal about how mergers work is with regard to valuing the company. And just rule of thumb off the cuff, you would say, whatever the revenue was for the prior year, then, sort of divide that in half, and you might have a ballpark of where to start with for your valuation. Architecture firms are difficult because it's the principal, typically, who is the face of the firm and the person that the client interacts with and the go-to person. And if for some reason that person leaves, or heaven forbid, passes away, then a lot of the value goes away with that person. So the firm relies on that individual. And that's not really where you want to be with a business. So you've got to structure your business so it's not just about the principal, but it's more about your steady sales, staff, services, reputation, and everything else involved. But the actual valuation I would leave to companies that are out there. Lots of them deal with mergers and acquisitions. They will, if you're interested, you just contact one of them and they'll tell you. They may have an architecture firm for sale or someone who's looking to enter a merger, and they would be sort of your brokerage point for doing that and helping to evaluate the firms, both your firm and the firm that you're interested in buying.
Oh, yes. That's start at the end and work backwards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, Kathy, I know we've taken up a lot of your time today, and I want to thank you so much for being here. This is a very fascinating book. It's a great one for students or even professionals that are in the field that want to think about getting into their own business. So can you tell the audience, what exciting projects are you working on now?
Sure. We have a number of projects, commercial projects in the on the works and on the boards. We've got a university project in Baltimore, which is on a campus there, about over $100 million new campus building, labs and classrooms and other disciplines. We're finishing up a commercial office in Alexandria, Virginia. We've teamed with one of the largest firms in the world, I believe it is, Gensler, and we did architectural interiors for that project, and it's under construction now, so we're doing construction administration work. We are also the prime consultant on a project that's about to go out to bid, which is a forensic science lab, DNA and serology testing in the county. So we're really proud of that project, which will be a lead gold project, as well as a new elementary school in Maryland. We are, again, the prime architect, and that one will be finishing up construction documents and going to construction not until probably early next year after the students finish the fall semester. But I think probably the most interesting project that we're working on right now is a sustainable townhouse development, which is net zero project, townhouses for workforce development that'll be off the grid. They call it a microgrid infrastructure. So it'll be off the standard power grid. Tenants or the residents will be able to, move in with affordable homes that, have solar power and other energy resources, and still be able to purchase a home and live in the county where they work. So it's one of just a few in the nation. There, as much as we talk about sustainability and resilience, there really aren't a lot of prototype communities like this. So we're very happy to be on the early planning end of that concept housing for our local county.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. So you've got more books to write then, huh?
Exactly, exactly.
Well, again, Kathy, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to let our audience know that the book is The Business of Architecture, Your Guide to a Financially Successful Firm by Kathy Dixon, Timothy Kephart, and Carl Moody, published by Routledge in 2018. And again, this has been Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And if you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And thank you for listening today.